Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org, see our videos on YouTube, or catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Mark Sitter, chair of the ZEDMA Project, which is an initiative that strives to improve the national healthcare dialogue, which is what we're trying to do tonight. I'm also a member of the club's board of governors and, of course, your moderator for tonight's program. The congressional debate about repealing the Affordable Care Act is happening in real time. As most of you have heard, just today there's been a delay in the vote on the Senate bill, which is known as the Better Care Reconciliation Act. So that's a big mouthful, BRCA. I'm sorry, BCRA, wow. It's potentially one of the most dramatic entitlement changes in a generation. We heard just today that that vote will be delayed till after the July 4th congressional recess, but should happen pretty soon. This is a big bill, right? If passed and presumably reconciled with the House bill, which was called the American Health Care Act, in that case, it would do a number of things. Republicans claim that it would contain spending growth that's otherwise unsustainable. They say it would stabilize the individual markets, that it would provide greater flexibility to the states, and it would cut taxes. Democrats aren't so positive about it, as you've probably heard. They say that the bill, if passed, would gut Medicaid. It would price people out of the individual markets. It would remove a lot of critical protections, not just for people on Medicaid or the individual markets, but for anybody with employer-sponsored health insurance. And it would also create a massive tax windfall for the wealthy. Now, those are radically different views of the same piece of critical legislation. So today we're going to hear from two former senior officials on this ongoing effort to repeal the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. Andy Slavitt, I guess it's obvious which one Andy is, served as the acting administrator for Medicare and Medicaid services under President Barack Obama. And Dr. Gail Walensky held the same post under President George H.W. Bush. Both are currently among the most widely quoted independent experts on U.S. healthcare reform, independent meaning that they don't currently work for anybody in either political party in that regard. I'll say a little bit more about each. Andy Slavitt first came into the public spotlight in October of 2013 when he was called in by the Obama administration to lead the turnaround of healthcare.gov after what many of you will recall was a pretty disastrous rollout. At the time, he was working at United Health Group as the group executive vice president for its Optum division. Prior to that, he was founder and CEO of Health Allies, a technology-based consumer healthcare company. Andy has been recognized by Modern Healthcare magazine as one of the 10 most influential people in healthcare. He has an MBA from the Harvard Business School. And since leaving government just a few months ago, he's dedicated himself to informing the public about all these efforts at healthcare reform and repealing the Affordable Care Act. He's been crisscrossed in the country and holding scores of town hall meetings all over the country, including in many places where the actual local representative doesn't show up, and he shows up for him and describes his thinking about the bills at hand. His Twitter following has grown since he left government from 15,000 to nearly 80,000 people today, one of whom is me, and I can attest to his prolific and very informative activity in that medium. Dr. Gail Walensky is not as much of a tweeter, but gets around a lot in any case. She's an economist and a senior fellow at Project HOPE, which is an international health foundation. She directed the Medicare and Medicaid programs and served as senior advisor on health and welfare issues to President George H.W. Bush, and she was the first chair of the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission. Dr. Walensky testifies frequently before congressional committees. She's flying back as soon as she can after this to go back to Washington for multiple presentations. She advises a lot of elected officials and speaks both nationally and internationally. It seems to me that about half of the articles I see on healthcare these days, and I see a lot, have Gail either in the body or the byline of the article. She holds a PhD in economics from the University of Michigan as an elected member of the Institute of Medicine. I first met Gail through my work with the Zetima Project and quickly came to respect both her concern for providing better health care to Americans of all socioeconomic levels and her views on how market forces could be harnessed to achieve that goal. So we are fortunate to have with us two policy experts with deep government experience from different parties who share a commitment to improving U.S. health care, though they have diverging ideas about how best to get there. Let's please welcome our panelists. Okay, so we're in the thick of the healthcare reform whirlwind, with a Senate vote looming over presumably the next few weeks. And in any case, we get a torrent of daily news about what's going on with the particulars of the bill and which senators might vote which way. There's a lot going on. But for a start, I want to give each of you 90 seconds. I know this is hard, but you've got a lot of practice in this recently. 90 seconds. Give me three things that you think are most significant about the healthcare bill, the Senate bill in particular, and your opinions about them. So, Gail, we'll start with you.
The first is an unfortunate aspect about it that was indicated on Monday from the Congressional Budget Office, which is that 22 million people who would otherwise be insured will lose their insurance coverage. I've had a lot of concerns about the Affordable Care Act, some of its provisions, but I applaud the expansion of coverage that resulted. Whatever the exact number is, the Congressional Budget Office estimate is directionally correct. And it is happening largely because of the amount of money being pulled out of Medicaid, $762 billion over 10 years. Medicaid's been the unsung hero of the Affordable Care Act. It's where most people have actually gotten their new insurance, even though we give all the attention to what's going on and not going on in the exchanges. There will also be some changes for people who've been having private insurance. Some of it not entirely bad. Others parts will be more questionable. If you are a pre-Medicare individual, you face higher prices in insurance, partly because the young adults who we desperately need in the risk pools had been cross-subsidizing the pre-Medicare population. In people's hearts, that may have felt good. From public policy, it was a really dumb idea. Mm-hmm. We called them the young invincibles for a reason. Mm-hmm. We just made it harder to get them into the risk pool.
Okay. All right. Andy, what about you?
Well, you know, generally speaking, if you're talking to a Democrat about healthcare policy, they're going to be talking to you about coverage, about how to cover more people. And if you're talking to a Republican, generally speaking, they're going to be talking to you about cost. How do you make sure that healthcare is more affordable, both for individuals and for the country? And I think the first two points I'd make are that the bill does neither. The bill actually manages to accomplish to neither meet the more left liberal requirement nor the more right conservative requirement. It actually, as Gail mentioned, tens of millions of people would lose coverage. How many, we don't exactly know because no one can see the future. But it also makes healthcare less affordable. And in failing that test, it fails it because, and essentially, if you bought the same policy, if you read the CBO report, very interesting part, if you bought the same policy under Obamacare, you bought the exact same policy under Trump Care, you'd pay 70% more for the same exact policy. And so it fails the test of providing lower-income and middle-income people access to insurance, which is essentially what I think the Republicans campaigned about. So that's two features. And I think the third I would add is by far the most popular part of the ACA is the patient protection part, the part we don't talk about, but the part where people actually no longer have to wonder if they leave their job whether they can get coverage. The part where they never would have to wonder if they had a premature baby, whether or not a lifetime cap is going to keep them out of the market. The part that they don't have to wonder about whether if I buy a policy, does it actually cover mental health services or not? The part that essentially lays a foundation for the first time in our country where we actually have made a compact with our citizens to say, doesn't matter your health status, doesn't matter your income level, we are going to make an effort to make sure you have the same bit of protection and you don't have to go bankrupt from getting sick. Now, obviously, the ACA didn't accomplish 100% of that. Did it accomplish 70? Did it accomplish 60? Did it accomplish 80? Who knows? But didn't accomplish 100% of that. Washington hasn't allowed it to move forward. It sort of did what it did and then stopped in place. This bill, however, takes those advances we've made in coverage and it makes them worse. And then it takes these other elements, makes it more expensive, and of course it loses the patient protections. And I think those are the three things that I take away from the bill.
Hmm. Sounds like besides that, you like it though, right? So one of the biggest changes on the Medicaid front in the bill, from what I could see, is not only there's less money going in, and to some degree, that although that sounds terrible, the supporters of the bill would say, well, it's not about Medicaid, it's about covering people, and some of what they're trying to do, I believe, is to switch people from Medicaid to the private market by giving them subsidies. So in the notion that it's better to buy health care on the private market. So Gail, I'll start with you on this. Do you think that's a good idea in general to move at least some of the people from Medicaid to the private market? And if so, do you think that this bill, the Senate bill, adequately funds that switch?
Well, I don't think I would characterize what they're doing in that way. There actually is one very important provision that Andy didn't mention, that for people who are under the poverty line, they will now be able to receive subsidies, which because of the peculiar way the Affordable Care Act was written, they were not able to do. And so the individuals who were below the poverty line in states that didn't expand their Medicaid were without any kind of support. That will now change. That's actually one of the important pluses that happened. There's something very bizarre going on in the Medicaid program. Andy and I have talked about this. I think we agree it's peculiar. We don't really agree on the fix. And that is that the poorest people, the original base Medicaid population, gets their states get matching support from the federal government that varies between 50 and 73%, depending on how poor. The poorer the state, the higher the match. In order to try to make this absolutely an offer that states couldn't refuse, although 19 did, in part because of some uncertainty about what would happen when this stopped, the federal government paid 100% for 3 years of Medicaid, and then it's in the process of moving it down to 90% match. Not surprisingly, more was spent than was expected, even on a per capita basis. More people came in than was expected. And more was spent, perhaps because it's not the state's money now. Mm-hmm. Maybe because the people brought in more postponed health care needs or some combination that you see. What the Senate has proposed, and the state, the House also, but in a different way, is to move down that high match toward where the normal match is. One of the reasons many of the states that didn't come in, is they never believed 90% was where it was going to stop. And frankly, I don't believe it either. I don't know whether we'll go back to the old 50 to 73%. I don't know that that's what has to happen. But the notion that somehow the federal government pays less for the poorest people and more for the low-income, non-poor populations, and that they're different match rates, makes no sense at all. It's one of the things at some point we have to get together, maybe a blend. This is what's causing a lot of concern by some of the Republican senators in states that did expand their program, is the states have gotten used to this extra money. They've expanded their population, and they would be at risk for a lot more money or pushing people off of the Medicaid program. Mm-hmm. If it drops back. So this is still yet to be played out. Any state that thinks the Medicaid match is going to stay at 90% for the expanded population, you're asking for a big letdown. It's only what and how long it takes to get there.
So Medicaid, sort of some people say it's the unsung hero of American healthcare.
I use that term very frequently.
70 million plus Americans get funding for Medicaid. Some people say, a majority of people in long-term in nursing homes and long-term care facilities are funded that way. Most Americans know someone who's on Medicaid, and maybe a lot of people. And again, we had the base group that were on Medicaid before the Affordable Care Act. That 90%, 100%, 90% match you were talking about is for the expansion,
right,
which, again, many states did not. And the Republican bill would take money away from both of those in various ways. How much of it is just about money, that this bill would be an okay bill if it was sufficiently funded, and how much of it is wrongheaded entirely? Andy, what do you think?
I think that you do. I mean, I think that, let me just finish the thought turn it over to Andy, that you have to rationalize something about the Medicaid program. You do not have to take it down to the lowest level that it had been. There's nothing wrong with averaging between the 50 to 73 and the 90%. It just is weird. It's backwards to have the federal government doing the high match for the least poor population, mm-hmm, and the lowest match for the base poorest population, and it makes no sense to have different match rates. Bringing them together makes a lot of sense. Necessarily going to the old lower level, that's a question of what you want to do with the money. That could be adjusted, and I think should be. And ultimately, if this is going to go anywhere, something is going to have to give, because they're not going to get 50 Republican votes the way it's structured now. There are too many who are pushing back, although, of course, some of them are pushing back because it doesn't go down fast enough, far enough.
Yeah, that's it. Andy, what do you think about the issue about money?
I wish this was a high-minded policy debate about Medicaid we're having, and that we had people like Gail testifying in open hearings about how to do smart Medicaid policy. But that's not what this is. This is about, frankly, a president that came in with only a couple of adjectives to describe what he wanted in healthcare, and a Congress, a House, that had a lot of ideas. And so when folks campaigned on repealing and replacing the ACA, they were very clear on what that meant. That meant lower deductibles. That meant people thought they were going to get more affordable insurance. They thought the things that they don't like about healthcare were going to be addressed. But that's not what Paul Ryan did. Let's be very clear. What Paul Ryan did was he took a 25% cut out of the program that serves babies, mothers, people with disabilities, seniors. That's what he did in order to pass a large tax cut. So there's plenty to do. There's always plenty to do in all elements of healthcare, including Medicaid. I wouldn't pick on Medicaid, by the way, to make it more, perform better, structure it better, make it more efficient. I think Gail's points are actually correct. But that's not what's driving this bill. What's driving this bill is the $1 trillion that they want to take out of communities that serve families, that go to rural hospitals, and take it in the form of a tax cut for wealthy folks and for corporations. If they didn't do that, if they said, hey, let's have a Medicaid policy process and bill that leaves the money in, or makes it more efficient, I think we'd be having a very different conversation. That's not the national debate right now, sadly.
So, Gail, I mentioned everywhere I look, your name seems to be, and that was true yesterday with an article in the Wall Street Journal that was the output of a group that was convened by the Convergence Center for Policy Analysis of 8 or 10 leading healthcare policy experts from both sides of the aisle. And it was an interesting article because it talked about looking for areas of common ground. And there were plenty of places of argument and not agreement, but two main principles were presented as areas of general agreement. And they were: public subsidies for private insurance premiums should be means adjusted to make coverage more affordable for lower income people. And number two, states should be given more flexibility to streamline coverage options, both Medicaid and also the related Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP program, and other public insurance. So these are two areas identified as places where we could have bipartisan agreement. So my question for you is, how well does the Senate bill square with those principles?
Well, it's better than what the House bill did. There's actually a problem that the House bill and the conservatives worry about, which is not or shouldn't be dismissed as without basis. The concern that has been raised is if you have an income-related subsidy, which I do support, because at the end of the day, you can't get the job done mm-hmm. without it. But there is a real concern that's raised. The concern is this is not the only program that the people who are affected with an income-related subsidies face. This is the same population frequently on food stamps, receiving housing allowances, sometimes subject to their earned income tax credit, and other programs. If you look at what that means in terms of what they gain if they work a little more, and you add what us economists call the implicit marginal tax rates together, you make working more not so attractive to a group that has less attachment to working than most of the middle or upper middle class. And that's one of the problems that the conservatives in the House particularly have focused on. To just say that's not an issue is to dismiss something inappropriate. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, I would still say you've got to do that, have it income related, because you can't get enough help to the people right above Medicaid, wherever you cut it off, at poverty, 135% of poverty, it doesn't matter, and not have a gigantic bill in front of you. But it's not to say don't just dismiss this as an issue. With regard to the Medicaid part, the problem is that too much money was being pulled out. I was furious as a former Medicare head and MedPAC chair that the Democrats had expanded the Medicare tax, raised the rate, and expanded the base, not for what it should be done for, which is fixing Medicare. If you don't know it, this is the next crisis du jour waiting for us, but to use it to expand coverage for the under 65. That was very unfortunate because we need that money for something else, but you need to find funding somewhere, and that was what was used. To have it go back for a tax cut is not going to get these problems solved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, Andy, as we're talking about Medicaid now, it's the biggest single expense for most state budgets, right? So it's a real tough one for the state governors. And Republicans have long argued that individual states should have more flexibility, right, in how they spend those dollars since it's their big budget issue. And if we grant more freedom in terms of how they spend that and give them more flexibility and less regulation, states would experiment with different ways to deliver care at lower rates that would make sense for their populations. And we'd at least occasionally get something that's better than the one-size-fits-all policy that we have. So this Republican bill is designed to try to allow states more flexibility. What, if anything, is wrong with that approach?
It's the right idea, but the bill fails at it. There's a sentence in the CBO report which says that states get no more flexibility from per capita caps than they have today. And that's very important. Look, I was the CMS administrator when Governor Mike Pence said he wanted to expand Medicaid and do it with health savings accounts, and we approved it. I was overseeing CMS when Arkansas came to us and said they wanted to offer private insurance products instead of Medicaid, and we approved it. Now, the difference, by the way, is they funded it adequately. What this bill does, just to be clear, to go back to the point Gail was making, it offers people below 100% of poverty level access to an insurance product with a subsidy. But guess what? It has a $6,000 deductible. So forget it. This is policy in name only. So it will solve nothing in the real world. So we actually need policies that we know work for people. And the bill doesn't do that. I would say we could go further in giving states more flexibility than we have. And I would probably say the Obama administration could have gone further. And I support some efforts to go further, but with guardrails. So the other thing that's in this bill is it creates a new waiver. It's not a new waiver, but it makes it a different kind of waiver called the 1332 waiver that was originally designed to say states can innovate so long as they meet coverage and cost goals. So what the Senate bill does is it basically keeps the first half of that sentence and says states can innovate, but it says nothing about what they have to do with the money. So technically now, if this bill passes, states could take the money designed for tax credits for low-income people, and they don't have to spend them on that. There are zero guardrails. And that is a problem. So I'm in favor of flexibility, but the federal government, as someone who oversees and is responsible for taxpayer money, giving states money without any guardrails and saying that they don't have to spend it on low-income people for their health care is irresponsible. I think Gail agrees with that as well. I think reasonable people do. But this bill was not written by reasonable people. It was written by a bunch of aides in a room very quickly.
Well, let me go back and talk about the 1332 waivers. This was probably one of the biggest disappointments for those of us who thought these waivers would allow the Affordable Care Act to really show some flexibility and give states an ability to treat their poor low-income population in a more coordinated fashion. Unfortunately, for reasons the Obama administration only knows, it was defined in a way that was very narrow and very rigid. Only the Affordable Care Act Exchange group could be considered, and it required meeting a budget neutrality rule for each and every year, even though Medicaid historically has allowed 3 to 5 years for budget neutrality. Because it frequently takes some time. You make an investment in year one or two. You don't have budget neutrality because you think you can have savings in years three and four. And the population on Medicaid and the population at the low end of the exchange is basically the same population. Sometimes they have 125% of the poverty line income. Sometimes they get more work or somebody else gets a part-time job in the family. And they'll have 150% of the poverty line. Regarding these as two rigid separate programs that couldn't be allowed as a continuum meant that you had people who got coverage under Medicaid, crossed the income line. We're going to have to change their delivery system because rarely did you have the same network of physicians and hospitals in the exchange as you had in Medicaid. So allowing a more flexible look at the 1332 waivers and at the Medicaid program so that you can allow people to stay put and move the money is something that is sorely been needed. Those are the kinds of flexible changes that those of us who want to see flexibility have pushed. Unfortunately, in Medicaid, there actually have never been any outcome measures. As long as Medicaid's been in place, I'm somebody that has been proposing now, since the 1990s, the last time it came up, that in exchange for flexibility, which I'm generally supportive of, I would like to see 5 or 6 or 6 or 8 outcome metrics that states have to provide information on their Medicaid population. The only thing we ever have in place are process requirements. We don't know anything about what happens to the health outcomes of the people on this program, and we never have. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of smart quid pro quo that could be in there. Is it in now? No, it's not. Could it be in? It could. So, yes, you want to give people and states more mm-hmm. flexibility. You want to see something that at least allows you to have some reasonable way of seeing what happens to the population affected. People may think we know. We've never known in Medicaid. Not when I ran it, not when Andy ran it.
Let me close up, I wanted to say, first of all, I want to agree with Gail. I think the Obama administration did create too rigid of an approach to the 1332 waiver process. And I will just say that it wasn't the approach wasn't unanimous, and I won't say which way I went because it was a closed door. But I think we could have been more open. But let me be very clear, though, about what this Senate bill does. It actually technically allows a state to shutter their Medicaid program. Instead of just saying what Gail said, which is to allow an individual who goes between Medicaid and an exchange population to do so more seamlessly, that would be fine. That would be great. But because there's no guardrails, it effectively allows a state to just take everybody in the state, should they choose, and there are states that absolutely would do this. There are governors I think would absolutely do this and say, we're no longer going to have a Medicaid plan because we're going to give everybody a subsidy, and good luck to them all. And by the way, that subsidy sufficient only to buy a $6,000 deductible policy, unless that state decides to add more money. And guess what? These aren't the generous states. So we are going way too far here. We should have gone a step more towards flexibility. This is a step in a completely outrageous direction.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
I just got a different question, because certainly one of the most talked about parts of the Affordable Care Act, and probably the most popular part of it, and one that President Trump promised he'd retain, is, of course, the rule against insurers being allowed to exclude people who had pre-existing conditions. All right. And this, by the way, goes beyond Medicaid. It goes beyond the exchanges. This was one of the things about the Affordable Care Act that affected everybody with employer-based insurance, which probably accounts for a lot of people in this room. Right. So that was big. The Senate bill doesn't explicitly change that. However, there are some sort of backdoor elements of that, correct, which would effectively allow insurance to limit which conditions they would have to cover. So wouldn't that mean that insurers could either charge those people more and really effectively price people out of the market who have pre-existing conditions, either in the premium side or the deductible and coinsurance side?
Well, first, let me – you have not quite – explained what existed before the ACA. So let me remind people what existed before. Those of us who are on employer-based insurance, which most people are either on employer-based insurance or Medicare, especially looking around this room, I would gather, you had protection as long as you maintained continuous coverage.
Is that because they look employable or old?
I'm supposed to be asking the hard questions here.
That meant, and this is through HIPAA, 1996 it was passed, that as long as you maintained coverage, you were in a firm of two or more, or in some states, even if you were in individual insurance, they provided the same protection, you were protected against pre-existing conditions. One of the big misnomers when the ACA was passed was for many people, including many Republican congressmen, didn't know they actually had the pre-existing condition protection passed in 1996. Either they weren't there, they never paid any attention to the legislation that was passed there. The real change in the Affordable Care Act was for people who had individual insurance. The 17 million, roughly, who bought their own insurance with no subsidy, none of the tax advantages, those of us who have employer-sponsored coverage. And they, unless they lived in New York or Massachusetts or a few other states, didn't have the pre-existing condition protection. The rest of us, as long as we maintain coverage, can have 60 days without, had that coverage. So the notion that this was only as a result has just been a misunderstanding. It doesn't mean it isn't important. It is important. But it means that it actually resulted in less change than people were frequently aware of. It leads to the question, is if you want to have pre-existing condition protection, and the Senate legislation believes that it had that in, at least it requires community rating, you need to have a way to keep people insured. That was why they had the provision in HIPAA that says you have to maintain continuous coverage to have this, but we'll let you have 60 days in between jobs unless you buy your protection through COBRA. That will cover you. And one of the ironies is that the Republicans who have railed against the mandate, very unpopular for both Republicans and Democrats, and who want to have pre-existing condition protection, don't want to have something like a mandate or a surcharge, the 30% surcharge, But you've got to pick your poison. You want to protect people with pre-existing conditions who are predictably high-cost individuals, then you've got to keep them in the insurance. For all of you who are on Medicare, who are about to go on Medicare, you better understand that you get the year in which you turn 65 or you stop having employer-sponsored group coverage to decide whether you want the voluntary parts of Medicare, the Part B that pays for physician and Part D that pays for drugs. You don't have to, but if sometime down the road you decide you want this, you will pay a fee, a penalty, for every month you delayed. Not for a year, like 30% surcharge, for as long as you live. Now, this is one heavy-duty incentive. We impose it on our seniors, and nobody has ever complained about Medicare mandates. So if we were only partly that harsh on our under 65, we could resolve a lot of these problems and not have to decide which way we want to go.
So the incentives weren't sufficient, say, in the Affordable Care Act for that?
They weren't there, and they're not now in the proposed alternative.
But going back to my question, at this point, are you concerned that the Senate bill will allow states to ask for waivers, and suddenly you'll have, in effect, the pre-existing condition clause will...
I don't think you won't have the pre-existing. They're quite clear about requiring community rating. What you will be able to have some states do is attempt not to have coverage of certain areas, and probably mental health and substance abuse is the biggest concern for some states because of the costs involved. I don't think they're doing this as a pre-existing condition exclusion. They're doing it because they're worried about the spending on there.
The cost overall. Yeah.
But, of course, that doesn't get the treatment to the people who are affected.
This is what I like to think of as a high five and a wink. So the high five is we actually can say the words in the bill that we're not excluding people with pre-existing conditions. Here's the wink. The wink is we say we'll cover cancer patients. We just don't have to cover cancer treatments. And let me just tell you what happens in the real world, because this is the real world we did live in before the ACA. If you're an insurance company, the last thing you want is to be the only insurer in your state that offers expensive HIV drugs and cancer treatments. Because guess what? If you're the only one, which people will join your plan? And you can't get compensated enough for that. And so because you don't know what the other plans are going to do, you have, in effect, a race to the bottom. So in half the population before the ACA could not buy a policy unless they were employed. Half of the non-employed population couldn't buy a policy that had maternity coverage. So we can say that they can say all they want, Scout's honor. There's no pre-existing condition exclusion because they found a way around it, but it's a joke. What the CBO said is that half of the population in America will live in a place that has protections against all essential benefits being covered, that has no caps, and therefore has pre-existing condition protections, and the other half of the country will not. And you know what? I just don't think that's very good for society. I really don't. And I think it'll happen in exactly the states that have low-income people, that are most troubled, that happen to be red states. And I think this furthers and worsens the divide. In the name of what, I just don't know. Again, it goes back to the point that, the very valid point that Republicans start from a standpoint of, we want to take the cost of insurance down. It's a noble goal. The problem we all know is, you could take the cost of insurance down, but if you take it down by having it cover fewer things, you don't take what people spend down. So it doesn't matter. So again, there's hollow victories, and part of the reason is because they don't spend the time with very smart policy people like Gail and others on these bills. They don't spend 12 months. They don't have open hearings. They try to rush through a policy which effectively is a tax policy.
Well, and taxes are, of course, a big part of the discussion here. We've got some questions here about this, too, about the tax cuts, so-called tax cuts for the rich. Now, my understanding is there were taxes in the Affordable Care Act that were primarily levied on people making over $250,000 a year. So the tax cuts, they're all mostly accrued to the same people, correct? But that's
that was the Medicare taxes that I was referencing. The way the Affordable Care Act was financed was mostly by paying everybody who provides a Medicare service less, unless the physicians were excluded because we hadn't figured out how to fix that problem. Every other institution, clinician, group providing services, that was $760 billion of the $1.1 trillion came out of paying people less under Medicare. There were a bunch of nuisance excise taxes on insurance companies, pharma companies, medical devices, which made no policy sense but raised money. And the other large part was the Medicare tax expansion of the base, taxing unearned income for the first time for high-income individuals, and raising the rate on high-income individuals by roughly a percentage point, which, again, to me, was a bad way to raise money to cover expanded coverage for the under 65, because we desperately need to figure out what we're going to do to shore up the finances for Medicare, where we've made promises that we have no way currently of funding, and that's what we should have used that money for. Giving it back and not using it for either is then just giving money back. But it was a peculiar way to have gotten money in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Look, the ACA, look, let me just be clear on the record. The ACA expanded the life of the Medicare Trust Fund by 10 years.
Because it paid less to people providing services.
And well, but also, Gail, going into, and if we're being completely candid, the Medicare Advantage had 115% of Medicare, paid 150% of Medicare. There were loads of profits. And let me just tell you, I'm going to just assert this. Insurance companies are doing just fine. Uh-huh. They're doing just fine. And I don't have a problem. I'm not bashing on insurance companies. We were able to bring that down, and I don't think it affected one Medicare beneficiary that I'm aware of in a negative way. So, look, I think the reality is this bill does provide tax cuts, tax breaks that are extraordinarily irresponsible. I'm going to give you one footnote. The 400 wealthiest people in the country are getting would get a tax cut sufficient to cover full Medicare expansion for four large states. So we're going to give 400 people who don't notice it, don't need it, and don't want it, some may want it, a tax cut to take care away from citizens in four states of people that will desperately need that care. So look, recognizing that this is not a healthcare debate, it's a debate about the distribution of income in our country and far above my pay grade, but I have a point of view. And my point of view is that we as a country can afford to care for all of our citizens if we commit to it. We just can. And if people disagree, we ought to have that debate. Mm-hmm. My biggest problem is not being disagreeable around that question or around the question around Medicaid versus taxes. My problem is that we're having the false debate. The president goes on TV and says Obamacare's dead and points to some county in Ohio and says, this is why we need to tear down the ACA. We ought to be doing, if we're going to actually do what we're attempting to do, which is rob money from the healthcare system to do tax cuts, let's go back to our districts, let's go back to our states, let's have that public debate, let's have hearings. We're not doing that, and you know why? Because everybody who's supporting this bill knows that that's incredibly unpopular.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California program, and we're discussing the problems and the prospects of U.S. healthcare reform. Our guests are Andy Slavitt, former acting administrator for the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services under President Barack Obama, and Dr. Gail Walensky, who held the same post under President George H.W. Bush. I'm Mark Zitter of the Zetima Project, your moderator. You can hear the Commonwealth Club programs on the radio, see our videos on the club's YouTube channel, and find us on Twitter and Facebook. I'm going to go to some of the audience questions. I can promise you we will not get to all of them because we've got a number of wonderful questions. The one that I knew we were going to get, in fact, I'm going to pair it with another one, is about why not just go to universal care, single-payer health care overall. Okay? And
I must be in San Francisco.
Yeah, you must be in San Francisco. Well, a lot of states have of course, explored this, the California most recently, and kind of put it to the side. Of course, you know, Vermont and Colorado also looked at it.
And?
All gave it up because of too much cost. And I want to pair this question, Gail, especially in your honor, which is, since many on the right think that we'd be better off with a free market approach to health insurance, how could we use the free market approach versus the single payer approach to try to get to full coverage for everyone?
People,
I'll give you the first crack at it.
People talk about a free market in healthcare. That's just an absurd statement. There is nothing more regulated than healthcare. It's only a question of how much, by whom, for what circumstances. The issue about, I've been asked, are we going to a single payer, or why don't we go to a single payer, for at least the last 45 or so years, and try to tell people, explain to people, this is a political decision. It's not an economic decision. It's not an efficiency decision, because you could get many of the same changes, efficiency, including the efficiency, by many changes that don't involve going to a single payer. It's really a question of whether you want this as a political choice. My read, San Francisco notwithstanding, is that the majority of Americans do not, at the end of the day, want to shift 18% of the GDP to the federal government. Now, I'm just telling you as a read of somebody who spends a lot of time trying to understand political dynamics, it is true that the coasts may. Mm-hmm. Massachusetts and Maryland and California and maybe the state of Washington. But if you spend much time in between, there is a very different attitude toward the role of regulation, the role of government. It is something where how you get coverage to people is subject to debate. In my view, at some point, I hope we will get our own uniquely American patchwork quilt that gets north of 95% of the people with coverage. Most of the so-called single-payer countries have up to 5% of their population that doesn't have coverage for a variety of reasons. And that was one of the reasons I applauded the Affordable Care Act, with many of its blemishes, that we moved in that direction, although even at the end of the day, that would have left us with 28 million people uninsured. But it is better than having 49 million people uninsured. And getting people coverage, although it doesn't do many things, is important both for them and for the communities where they live. We could, in principle, go to a single payer. But my read is most places, at the end of the day, California maybe notwithstanding, although California also has not gone this way. Vermont, little and homogeneous as it is, also step back from doing this, won't do it because of the transfer of power to the federal government. We could, but we won't. Mm-hmm. So that's my read of it.
Eddie?
Yeah, so look, I think Gail may be right about the middle of the country versus the coasts. But I'll tell you what, I think that's changing. And I think if you'd asked me 6 months ago, will we ever have something that provides coverage to everybody in the country? And we should just assert single-payer, universal coverage, Medicare for all. They're all quite different things. And but just starting with what are we trying to solve for? Do we believe that healthcare is a right the same way access to highways and schools are? Or do we believe, no, it's not. If you can afford it, you can pay for it. It's a good. And you know, I personally would start for the premise that it's a right. Now, if that's the premise you start with, there are ways to get there. But here's the thing that's interesting. You just give you two anecdotes. I just did a right wing radio program, self described right wing radio program, and the host said to me, he said, you know what? I'm about as conservative as they come. I'm just sick of this. I think we need Medicare for all. And he said, and I'm as conservative as it gets. So something's happening. And I will tell you, I've gone to Southern Colorado, to Air Force bases, meeting with hundreds of people, to wealthy suburbs of Cleveland. I've been all over the country talking with people, and Democrats, Republicans, purple, red districts, And I am sensing that the more people learn about this process, how it works, how it's done, all the actors, the things that they're not getting that other people are, they're getting a little bit pissed off. And they're getting a little bit educated. And so where 6 months ago I would have said what Gail said, which is this probably would never happen, never be a political reality, I'm not so sure I'd say that anymore. The second story I'll give you is I got the privilege when I was in government, and the first thing I would do every morning is I would read emails and letters that came in either to the president or to me from constituents. And there's one that just struck me, not because it was one about someone whose life was saved. There were a lot of those. But a woman basically said the following in her story. She came home from work. Her middle school daughter was home. And she said to her daughter, you can join the gymnastics team. And her daughter, she said, jumped into her arms and just jumped up and down and screamed and then finally said, but Mom, why? You've told me for 3 years straight I couldn't join the gymnastics team. And she said, Mommy has insurance. And that registered with me in maybe even a different way, because it made me realize how access to protections of health care, not having to worry about going bankrupt from something happening, really links us into the middle class like nothing else. And it's at that level, as we think about this, that we, I think, are shifting the debate in this country. So how it happens, I think it probably happens more closely to the way it almost happened in Nevada, which is you take a program like a Medicaid program and you allow people access to it and into it. And by the way, those would be managed care plans. Those would be insurance companies. So the federal government doesn't even have the ability to run a single payer program on its own, even if it wanted to in its wild fantasy. So I don't think that the middle of the country, so to speak, has to really worry about that. I think, but I do think the debate goes on. I do think consensus is reached in waves, and I think we'll go backwards and forwards. But this debate, I think, is crystallizing some movement in that direction, in my opinion.
I know it's hard for me to reconcile this notion that we are about to adopt a Medicare for all when you not only look at the last election, but you look at all of the by-elections that have happened since there. Again, I am someone who believes we need to find a way that works for us to get coverage to almost all people. I don't like using the Medicare as a right or health care as a right because I don't know what that means. It's not a constitutional right, I know that. I don't know what it means to what, paid for by whom, exactly getting what, but do we want to make sure that all or as close to all of our citizens can get access to health coverage? Yes, we want to do that in a way that is sustainable and supported by the people of this country, because otherwise it won't persist. Even if you pass the initial legislation, it won't persist. That's the kind of conversation that we need to have about what is it that we're willing to do. And it's not been happening. It hasn't happened before, and it's not happening now. I really do despair of that. The good news is it's not clear we're going to get change, because it's not clear there's enough consensus with a very narrow margin going on in the Senate. It might force us to see whether or not there aren't bipartisan solutions out there, or as I like to remind people, especially the Republicans I talk to, the ACA is the law of the land until it isn't. And at the moment, it's the law of the land. So it's something where either making it better or finding a way to have a better discussion about what it replaced still needs to happen, despite a lot of bravado that we've been hearing.
You know, Mark, and before you move on, you know, interestingly enough, reports coming out as recently as yesterday saying that the closing argument, one of the closing arguments, that the Republican leadership is using with its base to get them to support the bill is to say, if you don't support this bill, you will be we will end up with single payer in this country, and you will be responsible. So essentially, if you don't support If you don't support a bill that takes 22 million people off of insurance, you're going to be responsible for people gaining insurance, is the positioning that apparently the Republican Party is comfortable saying in published press. Now, I think their loss is not to say that the Democrats have perfect policy either. I actually think they've got it reversed. I actually think if this bill were to pass, you might see more energy around it. And look, if I'm a betting person, in 2020 or 2024, one of the major parties is going to run on a platform that's Medicare for All. I could be wrong, but I think that's the direction that the Democratic Party is likely headed.
Well, maybe the direction the Democratic Party is going, we'll see whether or not actually happens. And you ought to know that Medicare for All, which was the banner that Bernie Sanders was using, had no relationship to the Medicare program we actually know. So before you sign up for that, you might want to just check about what this program that was at least proposed during the last campaign actually involved. Nothing approaching Medicare. Now, it may be fine for you. I'm not saying it. I'm just telling you, this is a term that's used because it's comfortable. People like Medicare. They're used to it. So invoking the Medicare term makes people feel warm and fuzzy and like they know what they're doing. You got to look at what's actually being proposed in terms of the kinds of powers. This is nothing like what we have Medicare. We could do it. I don't like people who use words to mean something you think you know, but they mean it.
I'm not talking about Bernie Sanders. But suffice it to say, we will. Gail's correct in the following way. We make incremental progress in this country. Betting on radical progress is a bet that's a tough bet to make, which is why I think state-level activity is where we're going to see progress.
Wow. I'm trying to think about how to phrase this question, because I think that both parties and all these bills and the Affordable Care Act all punted on a key question, which is how do you make healthcare actually more affordable? That's an underlying delivery system question, okay? Healthcare, as you say, 1/6 of our economy, 1 out of 9 jobs in the country. If you think that Medicare for All or universal healthcare means it's going to be like other developed countries, which are 30, 40, 50% cheaper, where's that money going to come from? I can tell you where a place it could come from, all completely politically unpalatable, and all that would affect a lot of people in this room and their incomes and their stocks and everything else. Doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. But that's the challenge. So that leads to my next question, which is that the Senate bill pegs the Medicaid growth rate in the future, what it's going to reimburse, at lower and lower numbers until in 2025 we get down to the level of the consumer price index and general inflation. Now, everyone complains about that because that's, quote unquote, a cut. It's not really a cut. It just means less growth rate. But clearly, under current assumptions, that would be a lot less money than is needed in the Medicaid program. However, isn't it a laudable goal to have health care costs rise at the same rate as the rest of the economy?
We tried that for a long time with the physicians. I don't know if there are any physicians that are practicing.
Yeah.
It's called the sustainable growth rate. I pleaded with the Congress when it was being considered in 1997. Don't go there. Because we have never experienced it. This is just going to be a nightmare, of course.
Yes. What happened was every year the Congress punted for 1 year and finally
there's a fact. There's a fact you're missing.
Yeah. Well,
the only sentence I'd add to what you said is, and we're only going to do it for poor people.
Right. Mm-hmm. So would you be more comfortable if we did that for everyone?
Well, look, I think it would be more honest than saying we all of a sudden care about managing the long-term costs. Look, there is no question, and I think Democrats need to talk a lot more about costs than they do. I think it's a real problem. All you have to do is think about the last time you went to a pharmacy and actually saw what your prescription would have cost if you had to pay for the full thing, or if you had a family member who broke their arm, was in the emergency room for 4 hours, and saw a $10,000 bill to realize the unit costs of healthcare are way too expensive. So we have an issue, and I think you put your finger on something, Mark, that's quite important, which is that if you want to take care of some of those unit costs, we all have to get comfortable with the fact that we're addicted to jobs in the healthcare sector. We're particularly addicted to them in rural communities, and that's, I think, one of the things that's quite important. But here's the good news. Here's the opportunity in cost, in my opinion, and it's not something that happens overnight. But our problem in this country with healthcare costs is not the 67-year-old jogger with 2 Fitbits. That's not our problem. Mm-hmm. Our problem is the woman who lives two bus stops away from the dialysis center and probably two bus stops away from a grocery store. And if she misses a bus, she's going into renal failure and could spend 100 days in the hospital. And what's exciting is if you take those issues on, they're quite solvable. We don't need to split the human genome. We need to redirect our innovation energy away from the third Fitbit towards innovations that really help us get care to people who need it, that are older, that are poorer, that are sicker. And if we do that, we are going to take a real stab at it. Remember, the rest of the world overinvests in social services compared to us, and therefore they only need to underinvest in healthcare. We completely underinvest in social services and primary care, so we spend a ton more when people get sick. We've got to start changing that.
But we're not going to do it unless we can figure out a way to slow the healthcare spending. And it isn't just for the poor, for sure. But it means doing things differently and getting people comfortable with the idea that they may not have as fast access to every new technology, whether or not it actually has been shown to help them. It means providing different incentives for the people who are providing services, for the people who are using services, for the people who are selling stuff to the people who are providing services. We have created a very expensive healthcare delivery system that has remarkable innovation and research and development, and a very easy access for people whenever they want, need, or think they might need a healthcare service. But changing this will require a lot of changes, and it won't just affect the other guy. It'll affect people, and as we have an aging population, more and more people. They need to be comfortable with some of the easy access that they can have at any time for anything, whether or not there's actual any evidence that it does them good, would change if we actually want to change a lot of the issues that we deal with. We do spend twice as much on healthcare relative to social services as most other countries. Most other countries, it's a ratio of 2-to-1 social service to health. We're the 1-to-2. But we're not going to increase our spending on social services until we can figure out a way that we can slow the growth rate and keep it down so that if we choose to, as a country, we can spend more. It's just not going to happen if we don't get our arms around the growth rate in healthcare and keep it at a more sustainable level. But it will mean doing things differently and not just for the other guy.
And there was relatively little in the probably misnamed Affordable Care Act and even less in the Republican bills that really gets the underlying cost curve. And that's something we're going to have to mathematically have to at some point address, right, overall. And I guess the one other question I have for you there, Gail, real quick, is you're a market-oriented economy. You know, healthcare is not a free market. If we're not going to use the meat cleaver approach, just say we're going to pay less or stop paying, where are the best opportunities to use market forces in a productive, healthy way to try to make healthcare costs more reasonable?
It is appropriate and better to try to harness incentives to move you in the direction that you want to go rather than move you in directions you don't want to go. When we have had a fee-for-service reimbursement system for physicians or other parts of the healthcare, which despite all the rhetoric is still what we have for most clinicians, most parts of the country, what you're doing is rewarding people for doing more and more complex procedures as opposed to having better health outcomes. It is unhelpful. And for clinicians who are trying to do the right thing for their patients, frequently have to work against their own financial interest in order to make that happen. Keeping people out of the hospital and into their communities or home or into the lowest level of care that can help them would be very expensive for hospitals and hospital systems to engage in. It's why broader healthcare systems actually can do well financially by keeping people well and out of the hospitals in a way that hospitals really can't. What it means to be a market-oriented economist working in healthcare is trying to harness what incentives to try to encourage and reward and allow both the users and the suppliers of healthcare services to do within what is a generally quite regulated environment. I became this way because I was convinced that we are not a country that will have enough regulation that we will be able to keep people doing what we want them to do if that's going against the incentives we have implicitly or explicitly built into the system. And if we have the right incentives, we still need regulations. I was a regulator, after all. But we need a lot fewer if the incentives work for us and we reward institutions and clinicians and people's behavior for what we want to see, rather than trying to fight the implicit incentives by having some regulations in place. So that's really the fundamental difference. But when people talk about free markets and healthcare, it's like, what planet are you on?
Yeah, that's not what's happening. Well, we're about out of time, but I did want to give you each 30 seconds for one final question, and this is what it is. If the Republican efforts fail to change repeal the Affordable Care Act and it remains the law of the land, where does that leave our healthcare system? Gail, you have 30 seconds.
The Affordable Care Act is the law of the land until it isn't. There is some interesting legislation like the Cassidy-Collins, which has as one option, as a state, you like the ACA, keep it. You'll take a 5% haircut. If you want to do something else, you'll take a 5% haircut. You could match a high deductible plan with a health savings account, which fills it in. So unlike too many people now on the exchanges, you're not left with the $6,000 deductible, which is what many people are facing, or you can do something else. You could also have a new bipartisan effort, but you need leadership for that. I don't see where that comes from. No, I'm the Democratic or the Republican side, by the way.
Yeah.
I mean, there's as much intransience on that side as there are on the R's, and there's certainly more than enough on the R's. Yep. Something like the Cassidy-Collins maybe will get a second look.
Andy, quick thought about that.
Yeah, I'll give you two pieces to this. One, actually, there's three places. What should the executive branch do? And there, I would say, you know, President Trump has a choice. So far, he's chosen to ignore Gail Walensky's advice and not treat the ACA as the law of the land. He's not enforced the individual mandate. They've withdrawn efforts that really are what bring more of the young and healthy people in the market. And most importantly, he's left in limbo a critical decision about whether he's going to pay something. And a study that just came out from an independent third party says that now two-thirds, a full 66% of all of the increases in rates that are coming because of Trump's own controllable actions. So he'll have a choice. If this fails, he could continue down that path because he believes he can stick it to the Democrats, and that's the way he wants to conduct himself. Or he can stop and he can enforce the law of the land, and I'll leave it to you to decide what you think he's going to do. I don't know. I actually think his team is split. I think he's getting advice in both directions. In terms of Congress, I think there is low levels of trust. I think there are plenty of people of goodwill. I think there are plenty of ideas that people can put together. I think the trust is so severely damaged that's got to be built back if we're going to see something. But I will say this, bipartisanship happens only when partisanship fails. So if the majority party is going to do the simple thing, if they think they've got the votes to get it done, they'll try to get it done. If they don't, we can begin to build back. And then finally, I think the third place to look is in the states. I think the states, particularly given the philosophy of this administration, the states will have enormous opportunities to do more experimenting. And I think that's going to happen over the next few years as well.
Great. And I agree. That's what we're going to see at the end of the day is most of the activity going on at the state level. They've signaled that they're open for waiver requests and ideas, that could well be most of what we see for the next 2 years.
Great. Well, we'll be seeing a lot in the next 2 years, probably the next couple of weeks, actually. We are out of time. Our thanks to Andy Slavitt, former acting administrator for the Center of Medicare and Medicaid Services under President Barack Obama. And thanks to Dr. Gail Walensky, who held the same post under President George H.W. Bush. Also, thanks to our audiences here in San Francisco for all your wonderful questions, too. Sorry I didn't get to many of them. Also on radio, television, and the Internet. I'm Mark Sitter of the Zetima Project, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know, is adjourned.